You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The first bill Congresswoman Diana DeGette ever wrote passed with bipartisan support in the Colorado State Legislature, but then it was challenged all the way to the Supreme Court. It forced anti-abortion protesters to stay at least 8 feet away from patients entering women's health clinics, and it set the tone for her relations with conservative Christian groups from then on. She's just written a new book with the help of Daniel Paisner that looks at how the religious right has influenced public policy over the past 20 years. It's called Sex, Science, and Stem Cells: Inside the Right-Wing Assault on Reason. It's published by Lions Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Representative DeGette to the show. And should point out that you've been in Congress now for six terms?
I'm in my sixth term, 12 years.
And now are in the leadership as well.
That's right. I'm Chief Deputy Whip for the Democrats, where I've been for 4 years.
Well, but this legislation was at the beginning of your career. Did you think that that bill in the Colorado State Legislature would cause such a big stir?
No, when I first introduced the bill, I was trying to do something that would show Colorado was still a pro-choice state, because we hadn't passed any legislation around choice for 24 years. And so I thought, I would like to do something to really hammer home we were still pro-choice. And I wanted to do some really grand bill, but the pro-choice advocates came to me and they said, well, we have a problem right now. And the problem is that people trying to go in and out of healthcare clinics, in particular abortion clinics, are being stopped by protesters who are literally blocking their access, spitting in their faces, calling them names, shouting at them. And so what we really need is legislation that will just help the patients get in and out of the clinics. I thought, well, this is a no-brainer. I'll just do this and it'll be no problem at all. And of course, little did I know that would turn into the biggest bill in the legislature that year. It would work its way all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court as a freedom of speech issue, and then eventually set the tone for my whole political career.
Were your colleagues in the State House encouraging when you came up with the idea of that bill?
Most of my colleagues in the State House were oblivious when I came up with that bill. They didn't think it was any big deal until the religious right came out in force to try to oppose it.
Doesn't this also reflect what's been going on in Colorado politics? Because it has moved from being what might have been called a blue state to a kind of a red state, hasn't it?
Well, actually, Colorado was always sort of a red state, but that was only the veneer. Coloradoans, Democrats and Republicans alike, tend to be sort of libertarians. They're economic independence. They think people should pull themselves up. But they also tend to be social libertarians. I had a colleague one time who said, I don't want anybody to know what I'm doing when I'm jumping out that back window putting my boots on. And that's sort of the attitude. And this guy was a conservative Republican. So that's sort of the attitude we always have. But then the right wing, the religious right, moved in big time in the 80s and 90s.
And this legislation made you a lightning rod. How bad did it get?
Well, aside from the fights that we had in the legislature, as I talk about in my book, the protesters actually came to my house on a regular basis.
And you had a couple of young daughters at the time.
Your right.
Neighbors must have been thrilled.
luckily, my neighbors were supportive, but it still was really irritating. They would show up with 20 or 30 people, huge, gruesome posters. And after a while, they'd bring megaphones through which they would chant things like, "Don't kill babies, Diana," and they'd march around in the street. It was really quite the scene in a residential neighborhood.
And in the book, you say that you're not the child of Satan that your conservative critics paint you to be. But I was wondering, wouldn't a child of Satan deny that she was?
You're right. Maybe they would, but I don't think my minister would say that I'm a child of Satan. One of the things I talk about is the time that the protesters actually came to my church, which is Montview Presbyterian Church, sort of a mainline church in Denver, where I sing in the choir. And they came and marched around the church because I was speaking at the church. And my minister, during the prayers for the people, opened up her hands and said, "Dear God, we pray for those people outside exercising their First Amendment rights, that they may learn tolerance." That's when I knew I was in the right church.
The bill that you were getting in all this trouble for came to be known as the Bubble Bill. And you had already moved on to the U.S. Congress by the time it finally reached the Supreme Court.
Right. I actually was several terms into Congress when the Supreme Court argument came about. I thought to myself, well, the legislative process, unbelievably as it may seem, often moves faster than the judicial process. But I went to the Supreme Court arguments, and I thought I would lose. But I couldn't help but think all the whole time, this bill is so reasonable. What it did was it made protesters stand 8 feet away from patients as they went into the clinic. So the patients could both get in, and the protesters could make their words heard. And so I thought it was reasonable. And in the end, the Supreme Court agreed with me on a 6-3 vote.
Well, who dissented?
Scalia, Thomas, and
Kennedy, I think it was.
It was Kennedy,
which
yes.
Which was a surprise to me because I would have thought it was Rehnquist. And I would think that today, with the additions of Roberts and Alito, that probably would have decided differently.
6-3 is a pretty good margin, though. And one thing that came about in the arguments, several of the justices asked the opponents of my bill, well, how far should people have to stand? And they took the position that protesters could come right up to people's noses and scream and spit in their face, and that was the only thing that could be allowed. I think their argument was so extreme that even Justice Rehnquist thought, wait a minute, there have to be some reasonable restraints.
My guest is Congresswoman Diana DeGette, DeGette. She's written with the help of Daniel Paisner, Sex, Science, and Stem Cells, Inside the Right-Wing Assault on Reason. It's published by the Lions Press. But this whole thing really set the tone for your legislative career that followed.
Well, I've always been interested in women's reproductive choice. But then another event happened when I got to Congress, which was I was appointed to the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which sounds kind of dry, except for the Energy and Commerce Committee has jurisdiction over everything relating to health care, environmental policy, telecommunications, consumer protection, issues that relate to science.
So, and you asked to only be appointed to that one committee. Usually people come up with a nice list because you knew that, and also because Colorado is an energy state?
Well, Energy and Commerce is one of what they call the top three exclusive committees in Congress: Appropriations, Ways and Means, and Energy and Commerce. And I had heard that one freshman would be appointed to one of those committees that year, so I decided Energy and Commerce was the place for me, both because of Colorado as an energy state, also telecommunications, and also because the Energy and Commerce Committee is really the top policymaking committee in the House. And so I decided if I was going to go for it, I might as well go no holds barred. And I only requested the one committee assignment. And fortunately for me, I was in the right place at the right time. I had a good strategy, and I was appointed. So after that, I started working on not just issues of choice, but a lot of issues relating to health care. And I worked on the first state children's health insurance bill. I worked on, and then I was appointed chairman of the Diabetes Caucus. My younger daughter is a diabetic. And I became aware of this exciting new type of research, embryonic stem cell research. This was right before the presidential election in 2000. And so I started working on issues of research and cell-based research and embryonic stem cell research, and that's how I got involved in that whole area.
Did you understand at that time, I guess it was the late 1990s, why some members of the religious right objected to stem cell research?
Well, having fought in these wars since the early 1990s, I understood that any issue relating to sex or reproduction would be an issue fraught with trouble with the religious right. And embryonic stem cell research involves taking embryos, which are created for in vitro fertilization techniques, and then making them into stem cells, which can be turned into any cell in the body. And a lot of the true hardcore religious right advocates even opposed in vitro fertilization because their view is it's God's will whatever happens, and people shouldn't mess with that. People shouldn't make embryos for implantation in IVF procedures. People shouldn't do research on those embryos, even if they're scheduled to be thrown away as medical waste, as the embryos used in research are.
But some of the same people believe that there should be interventions in other cases, the Terri Schiavo case, for example. So is there a certain inconsistency there? Have you ever talked to some of the people who said we should keep her alive, although you could have said, well, it's God's will for her to die if you detach the tubes?
Well, I think there's an inherent inconsistency in their position. Many of those people also support the death penalty. And in my view, they should take the view it's God's will whatever happens to Terri Schiavo, it's God's will whatever. But they're not consistent in their views, but they are consistent in saying anything having to do with sex and reproduction should not be messed with. Just last week, I don't know if you saw this in the news, the HHS Department of HHS is passing around a proposed new rule that would say birth control is a, quote, abortifacient, because they say that birth control pills can cause a fertilized egg not to implant in the uterus, or an IUD can cause that to happen. And frankly, the religious right thinks even things like that should be banned.
Well, the Catholic Church has always been opposed to contraception.
Well, that's right. But the question is, should that be our public policy of this country?
Well, if you believe that it's immoral to deal with it in any other way, well, then that has to be public policy. If you don't, well, then policy has to be determined differently.
And, you know, that's one thing I say in the introduction to the book is I say that the people who think embryonic stem cell research should be banned also oppose they oppose every birth control method except the rhythm method and abstinence. They oppose, I say, sex would be reserved for marriage and be limited to procreation, and AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases would magically go the way of the dinosaur. That's what they think. Unfortunately, that's not what the vast majority of Americans think. And what we're talking about here is not how you run your personal life according to your religion. It's how our public policy is made. And I think the majority of Americans would be shocked if they knew the public policy that's coming out of this religious belief.
My guest is Congresswoman Diana DeGette. She's in her sixth term in the U.S. House of Representatives, representing the 1st Congressional District of Colorado. She also serves in the House leadership as Chief Deputy Whip and is co-chair of both the Bipartisan Pro-Choice Caucus and the Congressional Diabetes Caucus. She was also appointed vice chair of the Committee on Energy and Commerce, and she is the chief architect of the Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act, which we will be discussing in just a few moments. She's written a book with the help of Daniel Reisner called Sex, Science, and Stem Cells Inside the Right-Wing Assault on Reason, published by the Lions Press. Stay with us. We're back with Congresswoman Diana DeGette. Her book, Sex, Science, and Stem Cells Inside the Right-Wing Assault on Reason, is published by the Lions Press. Not long after he became president, I guess it was about August 2001, President Bush came out with what he felt was a compromise on the issue that he thought would satisfy both sides.
Well, the problem with what President Bush did was it wasn't really a compromise. It was a political act, because what he did was he said that embryonic stem cell lines, which were created before that date, August 2001, could be used with federal money and research, but embryonic stem cell lines created after that date could not be used. Now, President Bush said that his objection to stem cell research was a moral objection. And so it's hard to see how, if you morally opposed destroying embryos for stem cell research, you could use some, but not others. And what has happened with that literal cut the baby in half policy that he enacted is just wreaked havoc in the research community.
I've spoken to a number of researchers who've told me that they have to keep separate laboratories and they can't use anything on other research that they use on stem cell research for fear of losing federal funding for everything at their university.
Right. The HHS came out with a policy after President Bush's executive order, which said if your lab receives federal funds for anything, you cannot do research, even with private money, on non-federally approved stem cell lines. So that has effectively shut down stem cell research at any lab that receives federal money, which is almost every academic institution in this country.
So when you decided to write legislation to overturn the order, I'm sure you approached some Republicans. What was their response?
I approached some Republicans who I felt really cared about science. Now, remember, this was still several years ago where there wasn't a lot of knowledge among the public or among elected officials about what embryonic stem cells were. Some people thought they were from abortions. Some were just really unclear and, frankly, very nervous. But I found two people. First, Jim Ramstad, a good guy from Minnesota, and now Mike Castle, who is a wonderful member of Congress, who said, yes, I will help you with this bill.
I'm sure many were reluctant to go against the new president simply because that would be disloyal.
Many people were worried about going against the new president, and even some Democrats were nervous that these members of Congress are nervous about talking about anything that relates to sex and reproduction. So they were just nervous in general.
John McCain has said that stem cell research is all right with him as long as clone cells aren't used. Is that okay to you?
Well, it's not okay. To his benefit, John McCain did vote for my bill, and he voted to override the president's veto the first time. John McCain, though, because he has to cater to his party, which is controlled by the religious right, is now backing off. He's refusing to answer reporters' phone calls. He's being very vague in his responses. And the problem is, when he says that he's opposed to what we used to call therapeutic cloning, we now call somatic cell nuclear transfer, that's a related research technique. And that could be the technique that leads to clinical application of all of this stem cell research.
But cloning is a really loaded word.
That's why I call it SCNT, somatic cell nuclear transfer, because we are not talking about reproductive cloning. I oppose reproductive cloning. Everybody who's responsible opposes reproductive cloning. But SCNT, a related research technique, could actually be the cure for diabetes, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, all of these other diseases.
Although cloning has been an issue in Congress, and you've said that the hearings on human cloning became circus-like. There were even cultish groups like the Raelians who were testifying.
Yes.
How did they even wind up being accepted? I mean, I'd like to testify sometimes before Congress. I don't think anybody will allow me to.
Well, I certainly would invite you to testify. But the way the Raelians ended up coming to Congress, these are people, by the way, It's a cult headed up by a former French race car driver named Rael. And the whole purpose of this cult is to try to clone Rael so that they can have their leader into infinity. Now, this is a group which was actually invited to testify about cloning in front of my committee.
And who invited them? Somebody was trying to make ridicule the whole thing?
Jim Greenwood, who was my committee chairman, a Republican, but a good guy who supports embryonic stem cell research, thought it would be a good idea to bring them in to bring press interest. And believe you me, there was a lot of press interest. It was the sort of quintessential Washington scene with all of the cameras clicking, and Rael was there with his top knot and flowing robes, and they were all there in the hearing room. The problem was Rael and his followers were so crazy that when they finished their testimony and walked out of the room, all the press left too. And so the actual researchers who were there to talk about animal cloning and the problems and the differences with SCNT and research, they were all just speaking in a vacuum. The press was gone.
And yet Congress hasn't banned human cloning.
You know, it's interesting. Last year, I introduced a bill to ban human cloning because this is a serious issue, and there are people like the Raelians, but also serious scientists who are trying to clone humans. I think it should be banned. So I did a bill to try to ban it. The religious right came out against the bill because it did not also ban SCNT or therapeutic cloning. They said it didn't go too far. And so all of the religious right people in the Congress voted against the bill. I'm wondering how they're going to go back and tell that to their constituents in their re-election, that they voted against a bill to ban cloning.
My guest is Congresswoman Diana DeGette. Her book, written with Daniel Paisner, Sex, Science, and Stem Cells, Inside the Right-Wing Assault on Reason, published by the Lions Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is still really a bipartisan issue. Nancy Reagan came out for stem cell research.
Not only did Nancy Reagan come out for stem cell research, she spent a lot of time calling particularly senators and asking them to vote for our bill. Orrin Hatch, not the most liberal member of the Senate, has been a wonderful ally in this quest because he believes that it's the ultimate pro-life decision to donate your unused embryos, which will be thrown away as medical waste, to help find cures for diseases.
And Arnold Schwarzenegger signed the bill in California.
Yeah.
In his last State of the Union address, President Bush talked about empowering medical researchers and trusting in their innovative spirit. So has he changed his tune or just suggested that they come up with some kind of alternative to the approaches that scientists believe are necessary at this point?
President Bush is still firmly opposed to embryonic stem cell research. He somehow thinks researchers can come up with an alternative. And we have had a lot of exciting advances in cell-based research in other areas, but they do not. The mistake the president makes is that one form of research does not substitute for another. And so, and in fact, Dr. Elias Zerhouni, who's the head of NIH, explains this quite eloquently, how politicians should not be telling scientists how to do their work. We don't tell cancer researchers, do this type of research and not that type.
Now, your bill wound up getting the very first veto that President Bush ever issued. You perhaps were not surprised by that, but you do seem to have been surprised by the way he did it.
Well, we had heard that he would veto our bill. We were very saddened by the fact that he refused to even talk to us. I mean, this veto was 6 years into his presidency, so he had gone along for a long time without vetoing legislation. And he to this day has refused to meet with me and my Republican allies to talk about the bill. When he did the veto, he had a very public splashy ceremony surrounded by these little squirming children. And at first we couldn't figure out who are these children and babies with him? It's not the most optimal opportunity because it distracts from the message. It turned out that it was the so-called snowflake babies, babies who had been born by the donation of embryos by couples who had undergone IVF to other infertile couples. And I think there are less than 200 of these snowflake babies.
Well, you're not trying to eliminate those babies
no,
at all.
No. In fact, my bill would allow people undergoing IVF have several choices. They can freeze the unused embryos for later use. They can have them thrown away as medical waste, and many tens of thousands are thrown away every year. Or they can give them to other people. And what we wanted to do was to give them a fourth option, which is to donate them to science to be used for finding cures.
You say in the book that there are a surprising number of Christian conservatives in Congress who are arguing that condoms don't protect against HIV and most STDs, and that the HPV vaccine would encourage girls to become sexually active. Are they representing the interests of their constituents?
I don't think that they're representing the interests of the majority of their constituents, because the vast majority of Americans believe in birth control, and they believe 87% of Americans believe in science-based public policy. And so I think these members are really representing the far, far right. And this is some of the really shocking information that I think comes out in the book, is the thorough politicization of science in our political institutions when it comes to sex and reproduction.
Why did you include a debate between Representative Chris Smith and Nita Lowey?
I think that debate, which happened several years ago, it was an actual debate in the House of Representatives, just shows how wacky some of this dialogue and some of this public policy is. Congresswoman Lowey, one of New York's own, had a bill which would have allowed federal employees' health care insurance cover birth control, because after all, it covers Viagra. So she introduced an amendment saying that the insurance plans should cover birth control. Chris Smith, a very conservative member of Congress from New Jersey, introduced an amendment to that saying only types of birth control that are not, quote, abortifacients will be covered. And upon questioning from Representative Lowey there on the House floor, he basically admitted that he thought almost every form of birth control pills, IUDs, the patch, and so on and so forth, was an abortifacient. And so he didn't think it should be covered by health insurance. I find that shocking, and I think most Americans would too.
This also has led to a little embarrassment for John McCain recently, because one of his top advisors made the same argument that Nita Lowey made, and he had voted against your bill. Mary Ann Akers of the Washington Post, the sleuth blog, says that you waited to publish this book because you hoped that it would unite the Hillary Clinton supporters who are still reluctant to support Barack Obama.
Well, I actually published this book to tell voters that they need to really look at the records of their elected officials as they relate to science, not just abortion, but on all of these issues about birth control, international HIV/AIDS policy, because there are a lot of public officials who don't look at science when they do public policy. John McCain is a good example. John McCain, people think that because he's a maverick, he's a moderate. And in fact, that's far from the truth. He voted against federal employees programs paying for birth control. He voted against international HIV/AIDS programs that included condom distribution.
Because abstinence only is the approach that's preferred?
Apparently so. What these people think is if you tell people just don't have sex and they don't give them condoms, then they won't have sex, which is incredibly naive at its best.
So, and experts come on and argue that. What is the response when you speak with your colleagues? What is their response to that?
Well, a lot of them say things like, well, I know you're right, Diana, but I don't want to have to go back and tell my constituents this. Frankly, the whole subject of sex and reproduction and condoms and birth control makes a lot of members of Congress extremely nervous. One of the stories I talk about in my book was when we were trying to give American soldiers on the front lines the morning after pill. This is not an abortion pill. It's not RU486. It's the morning after birth control pill. And he said to me, "Well, Diana, I can't vote for that." This was a Democrat. I said, "Why can't you vote for that?" He said, my constituents are anti-abortion." I said, "But it's not abortion." He said, "I just don't want to deal with it."
Congresswoman Diana DeGette's book, Sex, Science, and Stem Cells, Inside the Right-Wing Assault on Reason, is published by the Lions Press. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.